Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is Big Brother compiling a privatised database on all of us to rival that of the Nazis? Big Brother watcher Steve Jolly's been at the Tory party conference this week to meet some of the movers and shakers and possibly the profiteers of the CCTV world, and asking whether there's any proper oversight of this increasingly privatised industry of snoopers. And the BBC 77 Conspiracy Road Trip aired on BBC Three last week. We talked to one of the participants in the show and asked, was the programme a bit of a conspiracy in itself? Plus, further developments with the bus rapid transit system here in Bristol, we get the latest from BCFM's transport campaigner, Steve Satan. And as ever, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots, which is where we start this week, Martin. We've had quite a serious incident, haven't we, with an aircraft, an A300 Airbus, a Russian one, which was on its way to Syria, being forced down by F-16 fighter jets over Turkey.
Yes, and obviously the Syrians aren't happy. The Turks claim that the plane had weapons on it. The Syrians deny it. But, of course, it's fairly open knowledge that the Turks, along with help from British and US special forces and the RAF, are arming, training and directing the rebels inside Syria. So for the Turks to complain that the Russians might be supplying the Syrian government with weaponry seems a bit strange, because they're supplying the rebels with weaponry. But I mean, basically, it's potential here for a regional war. That's the significance of it.
The plane contained, we're told, equipment and ammunition that were being sent from a Russian agency to the Syrian Defence Ministry. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan later told reporters in Ankara. The Associated Press has reported that. Anyway, Erdogan said Turkish authorities were examining the equipment and necessary steps will follow. What about the legality of this? I mean, you know, obviously there are arms being shipped around the world, as we've heard from many of the Arab countries to the Free Syrian Army. What's the legality of this, Martin? Is it okay to force an aircraft?
Well, since the Syrians are still the recognised government of Syria in the United Nations, and the Russians have relations with them, then deals between Russia and Syria are, in fact, it's basically air piracy to bring their plane down. This is what the Russians are saying. Now, the fact of the matter is that various powers that be are supporting various factions in the Syrian civil war, which is looking quite possibly going to extend to Lebanon, to Turkish Kurdistan, to Iraq, to the occupied territories of Palestine. There's a potential for a regional war. That's the real danger here. And if cooler heads do not soon prevail, before Christmas, we're going to go over the brink. And, of course, a regional war in the Middle East will whack the oil price through the roof, and that will crash the banks for sure. Could all happen before Christmas. Happy Christmas, folks.
We've also seen Syrian mortar shells landing in Turkish territory across the border, but there is questions over whether those mortar shells were actually fired from territory controlled by the Free Syrian Army.
Well, the German press are reporting that it was actually the rebels who fired those shells over the border. The fact of the matter is that the war in Syria is spreading beyond the borders of Syria. There's the threats by the Free Syrian Army to assassinate or execute prisoners that they're holding, that they claim from Hezbollah in Lebanon. And Lebanon, of course, had a horrible civil war that raged for over a decade in the 1980s and into the 90s. And so, you know, the potential for civil war in Iraq, the Iraqi government, Maliki government, which is a Shia-led government, have told the Turks, back off Syria, you're going to cause a major war. So we don't really hear much about it in the Western press. But the elected government of Lebanon and the elected government of Iraq are supporting Assad and not supporting the rebels. And, of course, the rebels are being supported by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, where they don't have any elections at all.
Well, we've heard also that this equipment that was seized from this Russian Airbus was military equipment, but they're not being very specific. There was one statement from the Turkish Prime Minister saying it was ammunition as part of it. They're not being specific about what kind of military equipment. Now, of course, it's worth remembering that the Foreign Secretary William Hague has said that they are giving intelligence, you know, which is arguably military equipment, support to the Free Syrian Army.
Well, the Free Syrian Army is quite clearly being backed by British, Turkish, American special forces at Incirlik Air Base. I mean, it's an open secret. Now, that's all very well, but the British people have got to understand that if your special forces are involved in training and directing people who are going around blowing up other people's police ministries, aircraft, what have you, that two car bombs went off in Damascus this week, killing a lot of people, don't forget the Syrians may decide if it comes push comes to shove, it's time to plant a few car bombs where you live. And of course, what happens in Britain and even more in America, people think they can get involved in all of this stuff and it's all happening somewhere else and it's nothing to do with them. But once it really starts, it will really start. And the way we're going to be hit is through the economy. If there is an attack on Iran, the oil price will go through the roof. The Iranians will take various countermeasures, which will be extremely unpleasant. One of the things they may do, for example, is sink all of the Western Navy in the Gulf, because they've got the capacity to do that with these Russian and Chinese missiles that they're holding. The potential for this to actually wreck the world economy is quite high, but the world economy may collapse anyway, particularly because of the Spanish debt going out of control over the next 10 days or so. And it may be that as the economy is ruined by the collapse of Spain, a war is started so that the war is blamed for the collapse, and it's basically Iran and Syria's fault that the banks have collapsed in the West, and that will be the explanation that the public are told to swallow. But it's not the case.
Now, we've also seen quite a lot of intervention by the European Union in the situation in the Middle East, particularly with Baroness Ashton, and one wonders who she reports to. I mean, as a sort of feudal baroness, reporting to the sort of feudal hierarchy than she is to anyone else. But she's never been elected. And we've heard today that the EU has won the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, do you think that the quality of these Nobel Prizes is changing over the years? Because it was the same when it went to Barack Obama. The idea being that you've got the Peace Prize and it's a way of trying to persuade them not to be involved in, you know, sort of getting conflict started by putting a Peace Prize badge on these organisations.
The Nobel Prize is a political football, has been for quite a long time. Interestingly, the Nobel Prize for Economics is actually given by the Swedish Central Bank, and they've actually got themselves onto the Nobel. They're nothing to do with the Nobel Committee, and the Swedish Central Bank set up the Nobel Prize for Economics, and they've given it, guess what, to lots and lots of right-wing economists. And so basically Nobel Prizes, especially not in science, things like for peace and economics and so on, basically it's a political football, and it's handed out to people, you know, in order to make them sweet or make them look better or what have you.
Well, I mean, we had Henry Kissinger, didn't we, given the Nobel Peace Prize.
Tom Lehrer, the satirist singer in the US, said, well, once Kissinger was given the Peace Prize, I gave up satire, because it's impossible to make a joke about these things anymore.
And of course, Kissinger was the man behind the coup in Chile in the 1970s.
Amongst many other egregious misbehaviors.
I mean, yes. Let's spend a little moment on that, really, because Kissinger is a very interesting character. He was Secretary of State, I believe, under Nixon, and then became an advisor to other presidents after Nixon in the 1970s. He's also, he was involved, wasn't he, in the Turkish invasion of Cyprus. He was implicated in that.
Bombing of Cambodia.
And the bombing of Cambodia. Also the coup
in Argentina.
Indonesia.
Up to a million people executed, yes.
So when the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded to somebody like that, I suppose it really somehow loses its luster.
Well, yes, and it was given to Barack Obama by the Nobel Committee because he wasn't Bush, and in the hopes that he would therefore, you know, take the Nobel Peace Prize and live up to it. But of course, he's basically carried on pretty much the same policies. The drone attacks continue across the Middle East and Central Asia, killing civilians all the time. And the wars drag on because there doesn't seem to be any end to them, does there?
Well, staying with Indonesia for a moment, the Bali bombing victims have been remembered today on the 10th anniversary of a terror attack. Hundreds have attended a memorial service in Bali to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the nightclub bombings in Indonesia that killed 202 people. The blasts were a watershed for Indonesia, which has the world's largest Muslim population, forcing the secular state to confront the presence of violent Islamists. The country has been largely successful in containing a militancy and There have been no big attacks on Western targets since 2009, when suicide bombers attacked two hotels in the capital, Jakarta, killing 9 people and wounding 53. Speaking at a memorial service held in Bali, Australia's Prime Minister Julia Gillard called the bombings, which killed 88 Australians, a failure in its aim of terror.
Yes, well, I mean, what people have got to recognise that Indonesia is a big country and there's been an awful lot of things going on there for a long time. We mentioned the coup in the 1970s, or 1960s, I think it was. In actual fact, Kopassus, which is the basically the Indonesian SAS, they have got a track record of bombing, shooting and killing people and blaming it on Islamists in order to bring power to the Indonesian army. So those in Indonesia, including a former president of Indonesia, are actually saying that these bombings were not what they seem, and that in actual fact they were possibly carried out by elements within the Indonesian state working with Western intelligence agencies, a bit like the bombings of Bologna in Italy, or the massacres in Brabant massacres in Belgium. Now, if the Western intelligence services can be involved in false flag terrorism in Belgium and Italy, you can bet your bottom dollar that they might be involved in places like Indonesia. And of course, what actually happened with the Bali bomb, because they killed a lot of Australian rugby league lads and their families, was that the Australians lined up like good little boys and girls to invade Iraq because they were under attack themselves, or so it seemed. But I don't know who carried out the Bali bomb, but I would actually say to many people out there, you don't know either, and don't presume you do.
Now, Siemens have been accused in an August sabotage bombing against Iran. A German company has denied the allegations, though, adding to the unfolding information about an August bombing that knocked out power lines near Fordo, Iranian MP Aladdin Brogiri accused Siemens of planting small explosives that were placed on devices related to nuclear enrichment. Now, this is a bit of a weird story. I'd not come across this one, Martin. This is a couple of weeks old. This is a couple of weeks old. I didn't come across it at the time. This is a so-called respected company that do, for example, control the transmitters of the BBC now, a former German company, former Nazi company, in fact. And they are apparently, the Iranians anyway, accusing them of putting little bombs in stuff that they've been selling to Iran.
Well, from the Iranian point of view, don't forget they've had the Stuxnet virus, the flame virus, all of which is directed at their nuclear program. Various of their nuclear scientists have been assassinated, and Mossad have basically said, well, we did it. The British, the Americans and Mossad are engaged in a war against the Iranian state, so it wouldn't be unlikely that somebody would have planted bombs in material that was going to be used inside Iran. And of course, the Iranians are being incredibly patient with all of this, because they know very well that when the attack comes, and it probably will come at some point, they will get their day. They will revenge themselves. And one of the ways in which they're going to revenge themselves, and I point this out quite clearly now, is they have lots and lots of what are called sunburn missiles, which they got from the Russians and the Chinese. They are designed to take out capital ships, aircraft carriers, destroyers, and various other major ships. What they're going to do on day one of the Iranian war is sink the Royal Navy and the US Navy inside the Gulf. It's going to be a killing field. If you sink an aircraft carrier, you're talking about 30,000 casualties. Now, people should think on before they say, we want a war with Iran. You'll get it, but you won't win. You're going to lose. And at that point, the ruling class in the West will really be on the back foot, just like the Tsar after the defeat at Tsushima in 1905.
The New York Times had an article about this recently too. An intelligence ministry announcement carried by the semi-official FAST news agency in Iran did not specify the intended targets or the type of sabotage equipment it said had been found. The announcement represents a new level of detail from Iran about the scope of sabotage attacks, and it appeared to reflect growing Iranian concern about security threats carried out in a clandestine way. Some equipment in question was put on display, FAST said, calling it the first such exhibition to show Americans, French and German equipment used for sabotage acts against Iran's vital and important facilities.
Well, yes, I mean, from the Iranian point of view, and don't forget, they have an elected government. Ahmadinejad did win that election, despite all the fuss that's been made in the West. It's not a free society, but then Saudi Arabia isn't a free society, and we do business with them. Iran is probably the most sophisticated, liberal-minded society in the whole of the Middle East, and in actual fact, we ought to be basically having a dialogue with them about what we could do to stabilise places like Afghanistan and Iraq. So instead, we've decided to pick a fight with them.
So what, in your view, is the problem with Iran? Iran.
Well, the problem with Iran...
The real problem
with Iran from the West point of view is that they won't do as they're told. They represent an unbiddable independent force, which is not acceptable to the Israelis, it's not acceptable to the Americans, and it seems that it's not acceptable to the British either. But the Iranians are just saying, well, we've been here all the time, and if you want a war with us, come on and get it. And they shouldn't presume. I mean, I've spoken to politicians in this country who said, well, we've got to keep war on the table with Iran as a last resort. I say, okay, why do you think that's a threat? The Iranian general staff have been training hard for this war for the last 20 or 30 years, and they've seen it coming a long way away. When it kicks off, they're going to go shock and awe their own style. And in actual fact, the West isn't going to like it. Most people in the West haven't really cottoned onto this, that they're going to war with Iran. That's going to happen. And they think, well, if we go, it'll be terrible, but we'll win. Don't presume that you will win. The Iranians have got an awful lot of cards in their hand. It's there. They're on their home turf. They've been training for years. They're going to give the West a bloody nose. And perhaps that's the only thing that will stop the militarist nonsense that comes out of Western politicians. If they see a couple of their aircraft carriers destroyed in the first hour, and then the rest of the Middle East really goes for it, then we'll see. I mean, obviously, British troops are trapped in Afghanistan. You might get to a situation where they say, we want to leave Afghanistan, and the Russians and the Iranians will say, well, no, you're not leaving. We're going to capture all of your troops in Afghanistan. How are you going to get them out? You've got to come through Pakistan, or you've got to come through Russia, or you've got to overfly our territory. Maybe the hundreds of thousands of American troops in Afghanistan are going to end up in Russian prisoner of war camps. Has anybody thought about that?
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, at the Conservative Party conference this week, Steve Jolly has been there, and Steve is a part of something called No CCTV, and I'm hoping he's joining me on the line right now. Hi, Steve, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Yes, I'm here, and thanks for having me on.
Now, first of all, Surveillance Camera Commissioner. This is something new, and am I right in thinking you've actually met this chap, Andrew Rennison?
Yes, I have met him twice now. The first time was back in March of last year, when we both gave evidence to the Protection of Freedoms Bill Committee on the CCTV elements of that bill. And then I met him again at the Fringe event in Birmingham on Tuesday, and asked him what he was going to do about these problems, because you may know that he's been in the media over the last few days. Or last week, warning that Britain risks a Big Brother society with things like police use of CCTV spy drones, new high-definition CCTV cameras linked to facial recognition. And he's basically promising to save us from this nightmare by introducing some tough new regulation, which, of course, is all a bit of nonsense, really.
Well, why do you say that, Steve? Because, I mean, there's got to be some kind of oversight of this, and isn't it quite a good idea to have, you know, Andrew, our Surveillance Camera Commissioner, that anyone that's got any problems with it can go to him?
Well, it only sounds like a good idea. At the moment, we have five separate regulators covering surveillance issues. We've got the Surveillance Commissioner, we've got the Chief Surveillance Commissioner, we've got the Surveillance Camera Commissioner now, which is a new post, we've got the Information Commissioner, and the Interception of Communications Commissioner, all looking at different aspects. And what we don't have is a Privacy Commissioner. We don't have anyone protecting our rights and our personal freedoms from this surveillance technology. And these various commissioners, what they're really responsible for is not defending our rights, but defending and upholding the particular Act of Parliament that relates to their remit. So, for instance, the Information Commissioner is really only concerned with the Data Protection Act, which basically says once we've stolen your data, we promise to look after it and not misuse it. Similarly, the new Surveillance Camera Commissioner is concerned with technical standards aspects of compatibility of systems and how the technology should be deployed. And the code of practice that he has been charged to write is basically a way of codifying into legislation, or at least some sort of rule book, because it's not a law, it's voluntary, the ways in which the government, the Home Office, the police, the private security companies can carry on snooping. So although it sounds like a good idea, it sounds as though, oh great, somebody's protecting us from these intrusions and these infringements of our privacy and our freedom. That's what we're meant to think, but it actually does no such thing.
Now, Steve, you had a success a couple of years ago with getting CCTV cameras which were put in a specifically Muslim area for no apparent reason other than that all Muslims, are, we're told, are suspects, terror suspects. You got these taken down. I wonder if you chatted to Andrew about your success in that and how he's going to be taking up those sorts of causes.
Well, I did mention that, and I specifically mentioned how a local chief inspector stood up in a council meeting and explained how these cameras were to prevent drug dealers selling heroin to your children and to prevent burglars from breaking into your homes, which was an outright lie because there was no facility for the local police to make use of any of this data gathered by the cameras. The whole system was a sort of MI5 counter-terrorism spying operation. But I maintain, and we at No CCTV maintain, that regulation is not the answer. Although it may seem and sound like a good idea, it's not protecting us. Because what we say about regulation is this: regulation does not address the core issues of removal of personal freedoms, anonymity and other rights. It simply endorses the acceptance of surveillance technologies by formalising their proper use and leaves no room for the rejection of such technology.
Well, I mean, why should we reject it? It helps in, cutting down crime.
Well, it doesn't. And all the research shows that. There's been, I can point you to 15 different studies, many of them commissioned by the police and the Home Office, over the last 10 years or so, all of which come to the same conclusion, that CCTV has had no significant effect on crime. But, of course, that's not the message that's given to the British public. We're told quite the opposite. We're told it's an essential tool. We couldn't live without it. And this is how we police nowadays, which is simply untrue.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier these high-definition CCTV cameras. What do they look like? I mean, if you're walking down the street, what do they look like? Because it sounds to me as if, you know, this is one of those things where it's almost like this is the new brand. You've got to throw away the old ones and get these new ones. And a whole load more public money is now going to be spent on CCTV cameras of this new generation.
They're not in common use yet, and they are expensive, so we're sort of beginning to enter the upgrade cycle. So what Andrew Renison is referring to is a future scenario. We're not there yet. But high-definition cameras are the next generation, and maybe they can pick out a face from half a mile away. I'm not sure whether that's an exaggeration. But particularly if linked to facial recognition software, which, again, isn't fully developed yet. They can only use it in certain limited applications, like at the boarding gate or the passport control or something. But it is something that we need to be wary of, because the technology is getting more and more extreme. Science fiction is becoming reality. And the technology has raced ahead of our ability to consider how it should be used, or even if it should be used. I mean, that's the more important question. We shouldn't just assume that because it's possible, we should try and look for a use for it.
Well, I think that's a perfect thing to say when we're moving on to talk about drones, because this seems to be also being used internationally as a way of killing people with no consequences, as a way of sort of getting around this whole problem with extraordinary rendition from several years ago, where people were being kidnapped, put in planes and then put into secret prisons. Well, now, what with the drones, this click and kill mentality where someone on a US Air Force base can kill someone and there's absolutely no comeback, and actually they can kill someone with no evidence that person has done anything wrong. We had figures a few weeks ago from two American universities that was saying that 98% of these victims of these drones in Pakistan anyway were completely innocent people. But and it does worry me that there seems to be an introduction of these drones without the Hellfire missiles on for the time being, but anyway, used as a surveillance tool here in Britain.
Absolutely. I mean, the only thing that's holding that back is the go-ahead from the Civil Aviation Authority. Once these drones have been fitted with sense and avoid capabilities to stop them crashing into each other and other aircraft, then potentially the sky could be full of them. And the police have already said, well, we want them for surveillance use. And of course, they say this will help them tackle crime and whatever use they say they're going to put them to. But it really is going to have a chilling effect. If the sky is full of spy drones that are basically flying cameras that are filming you as you go about your business, or potentially surveying your property and even looking into windows. I mean, it's a frightening prospect that the sky will just be full of, you know, it will literally be the eye in the sky. You may not hear them or see them. But what this is coming from the military-industrial complex that you mentioned. They're being imported back from the Middle East and being lined up for use on the domestic civilian population. But as you say, perhaps not with Hellfire missiles. But it's the same technology. You just take the missiles off and put a camera on, or a bunch of cameras on. It's really not something we should be relishing. And the police are saying, well, we can't wait to get our hands on these things. And the government ministers are saying, well, I guess that's okay, providing the use is appropriate and proportionate. And this sort of parliamentary language is really used to just sort of soften and disguise the true horror of it. Because, you know, can it ever be appropriate and proportionate to have the sky full of flying cameras keeping the population under surveillance? I mean, are we all suspects now?
Well, the thing that strikes me about this, of course, we've not seen any CCTV footage of the four bombers on 7-7. We've seen them on the dry run, but we haven't seen them on the actual bombing run. So you wonder what they've got the CCTV footage for if we can't see it. Also, of course, we didn't see any CCTV footage of the assassination of John Charles Menendez because apparently the cameras weren't working that day in Stockwell Station. So it seems that at crucial moments, the CCTV just gets switched off or gets wiped.
I would add the situation of Diana as well, that the CCTV wasn't working that night either.
Indeed. And the other thing I would say about drones, of course, is that all of this technology is two-edged. We had the struggle in Ireland went on for 30 or 40 years, and there was a massive amount of technology used to basically keep an eye on the Republican-minded population over there, but it didn't actually stop well-organised terrorists from being terrorists. They just worked around being watched, and that's what happens. And of course, drones can be hacked into, as we saw with the Iranians hacking into that American drone and capturing it. And of course, when you've hacked into a drone system, you don't actually let the other side know you've done it, but you can actually get to a situation where all of the technology that somebody's using against you can be used against, can be turned around. And the Iraqi resistance worked out pretty quickly how to hack into the drones that were being used against them. So the fight doesn't stop just because you've got drones. And I think the problem is that we're militarizing all of social space. And, you know, we're doing it willy-nilly without thinking about what we're doing. And we have to ask ourselves questions about why we're doing it.
Steve, I mentioned the Gestapo at the start of the hour. Now, they compiled massive databases on punch cards, which were supplied to the Nazis by a company called IBM, an American company, rented to them these Hollerith machines. I mean, you know, am I being a little bit too alarmist to say that we should really be keeping an eye on these big databases? Because who actually controls the databases of information about us and when this information about us is being collected through CCTV and other means?
Well, that's a good question, because, I mean, the government's currently playing a trick, saying that, we're not going to have a massive centralised government database. Don't worry. What we'll do is we'll access information gathered by private companies, and it will be distributed all around in various places. So we won't have a centralised government database. And I'm thinking particularly of this electronic identity assurance scheme that they're proposing. And most people will think, oh, that's okay, what a relief. But once information is digitised, then of course everything is connectable to everything else. So in a sense, it doesn't really matter where it's kept or where the server is or who owns that server. And this piece of legislation that's being discussed at the moment, the Snoopers Charter, the draft data communications bill, the Stasi would have loved that, because it basically proposes that the government can collect every email, every text message, every web page you visit, every phone call, every electronic transaction, everything you do, and build up a complete picture of your life for no other reason than the fact that if you're alive and you're a human being, then you're a suspect. I mean, this is the mark of a totalitarian regime, not an open and free democracy. So we're right to be concerned. We must challenge it.
Okay, so what about solutions? Do you see any way of reining back this technology and making sure that it's only used if there is the police have maybe gone to a court or to a judge and got evidence that this information needs to be kept because somebody is involved or at least is suspected and there is evidence that they are suspected of being involved in crime?
Well, that's it. I mean, if there's reasonable grounds for suspicion, the police already have all the powers that they need for surveillance, for gathering evidence on people. So they don't need this new legislation. This new legislation is all about gathering evidence on everybody. Now, I've never been against investigating suspects. You do need reasonable grounds for suspicion, and I would hope that you would need to go and get a warrant rather than just making it a blanket power that can apply to absolutely everybody when there's absolutely no grounds for suspicion.
Okay, so the bottom line is, who controls the CCTV systems around us, Steve? And who owns the control rooms and who employs the staff?
Well, again, that's a good question, because it's not just... Most cameras are in private hands. Most of the CCTV surveillance cameras are owned by private companies. They're attached to private businesses. A lot of them are owned by local authorities. A lot of them are owned by the police. Really, you don't know which cameras are owned by whom. Also, they have centralized, increasingly these days, privatized and centralized monitoring stations. So you have a CCTV monitoring center that will be monitoring some police cameras, some local authority cameras, some private cameras like shopping centers and stuff. And it is all becoming sort of centralized. You don't really know who's watching the cameras and who's in charge of the footage. And also, in terms of, you know, the phrase state surveillance, we have to start asking who is the state, because the state seems to be increasingly merging or at least getting into bed with private corporations like the big communications companies like Google, internet service providers, Facebook. So it's not just the government, the Home Office and the police that we need to be concerned about. All these private companies are gathering data on us. For instance, your Tesco's club card, the government has said, well, we want that as well. We want that information because it might be useful to us. So to go back to your question of what can be done and what do we need, I'm afraid we had the opportunity last year with the Protection of Freedoms Bill, which is now passed into an act, and that was completely wasted because we really didn't protect freedoms. We didn't restore them. We made a slight gesture towards it, and the press reported it as a wonderful thing, but really it's done nothing to restore and protect our freedoms. So what we need now is a royal commission into the whole issue of the use of surveillance technology, which would be a much more thorough and independent investigation and way of looking at the situation, because it will be masses and masses of information and evidence. People will be under oath giving evidence before a committee. We also need a proper public debate with a media that's awake and alive and informed about these issues. We also need a privacy commissioner rather than all these piecemeal commissioners looking at, you know, a one individual act or a part of an act. We need somebody in charge of our privacy and our rights that can look at things outside of a statutory framework on the basis of whether something is right or wrong, rather than whether it complies with the Data Protection Act or this Act.
Also, back in August, Steve, we had the revelations of something called Trapwire, a government spy network which was until then completely secret, which WikiLeaks has revealed. No wonder the American government don't like Julian Assange. Revealing this secret network called Trapwire over in the US. Is there any evidence that a similar sort of thing exists here in Britain, but it just hasn't been revealed or leaked yet to WikiLeaks?
Well, not that I'm aware of, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
You just tell us what Trapwire is and, you know, why it's so worrying?
Well, from what I can gather, it was basically linking up various different aspects of surveillance into one sort of centralized hub. So it was cameras linked to databases. You might be able to tell me slightly more about that, because it sounds horrific, but I'm not entirely sure The full extent of it. I mean,
well, yeah, okay. I mean, this was information that came from Stratfor.
Yeah.
Basically, what was going on is that although there were lots of separate CCTV systems in the US, which everybody was aware of, what they weren't aware of was that there was actually a system which linked them all together and enabled a kind of, you know, the sort of control room in the 1969 film The Prisoner. You know, where one person sitting in one can be looking at cameras literally all over the world and following people around using this, this system. But the most important fact was that this system was entirely secret.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's where we're heading. We're heading towards the sort of centralization of all these disparate and different sources of surveillance, and they're all being pooled together. Because, as I say, once you digitize everything, it's very easy to access from various places. And in America, you have these fusion centers. I don't know if you've heard of those, where that's a similar sort of thing, where they're accessing all sorts of information on the population. And it's really not to do with counter-terrorism or even organized crime. It's simply amassing huge amounts of data, collecting it all together from different sources, presumably because the government considers the average citizen to be a potential threat now.
Okay, can you just tell us where we can find you online, Steve, and follow your material, if you've got a blog or something?
You can find our website at no-cctv.org.uk. We've got a forum there. We've also got some very informative articles about various aspects of surveillance. And one thing I just would like to add about this regulation is the ANPR cameras, and what they've done is they've just sneaked that in with the definition of CCTV.
Well, this is the automatic number plate recognition cameras that we see along the side of the road, a sort of pole, blue poles and green poles, which were put up, really a system which was developed for following the IRA in Northern Ireland, which is now all over Britain.
That's right. I mean, we've made complaints and challenges to the Information Commissioner, saying that this ANPR system is really illegal. It's unlawful. There's no statutory instrument. There's no Act of Parliament. There's been no parliamentary debate. There's been no public debate. It's kind of been secretly built up. And now what they've done is they've just tucked it in to include it in the definition of surveillance cameras, and saying, "Oh, it's okay now. We've regulated it," trying to convince us that they've made it lawful and that they've made it sort of legitimate in some way. But the key point, I suppose, I want to make about regulation is that although it sounds like a good idea, it often does the opposite of what we think it does. So regulation can and does lead to an increase in the use of the very surveillance powers that it claims to protect us from. So regulation is a bit of a red herring, and look out for stories in the media saying, "Oh, don't worry, all this Big Brother surveillance technology is going to be regulated. There's going to be some tough new regulation." As I found with the Protection of Freedoms Bill, a lot of the media that were parroting that very same stance clearly had not read it, because if they had, they would have realised that it was basically a bill that said carry on snooping.
Okay, Steve Jolly from No CCTV, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Freeze, I'm Ma Baker. Put your hands in the air, give me all your money.
This is the story of Ma Baker, the meanest cat from old Chicago town.
Cat in all Chicago.
That's the sound of Boney M there. And if you want to hear the rest of the story of Mar Baker, then you have to track down one of their MPs, one of their LPs, or maybe even a CD if you're modern. So anyway, we're joined on the line now by John Scobie from Birmingham. John, you were featuring in this programme which was on last week on the BBC called The Conspiracy Road Trip. Can you just give us an idea of how you first came to speak to them, and what, you know, you said to the production company about what your thoughts were on 7-7?
Hey, Tony. Yes, that's right. Last week, 7-7 Conspiracy Road Trip aired on BBC Three. I was contacted in about May of this year to actually take part in the show. When I spoke to them initially, I asked them what was the thought traveling around the country. There's people about the 7-7 atrocities. Now, it's my understanding from a lot of research that I've done over the past 7 years into that day, that we don't actually know exactly what went on that day. Obviously, the government has given us a narrative, a story of what's happened. But in fact, if you look at the independent, or not the independent inquiry, the account into the London bombings, there's actually many holes in the story, and there are witnesses who see different things, and there's a recurring theme throughout the account that we are not fully aware of all the facts. When I spoke to the researchers from Renegade Productions, which is a production company that makes programmes for the BBC, they say that it would be an investigation of sorts into that date.
Now, the thing that bothers me, John, is when I spoke to you earlier this week, you were saying that the programme that you were with for a week being recorded wasn't the programme that finally appeared. So give us an idea of some of the things that were said during the recording, but that then weren't used on the final programme.
Yes, totally. Well, there were a number of issues are raised. I spoke to every person that we met. I pretty much asked the same question to initially: would they want a public or independent inquiry into this event? And everybody, through from people working in the police through to the government, family members, people who had been there that day, actually survivors on tube trains, etc., all said yes, that would be the first thing that they would want, would be a public or independent inquiry. Various people wanted either or for different reasons. I then sort of, in the programme, actually spoke about my concerns with the government's involvement in what they would call false flag operations, clandestine black operations, which there is historical context for the British and other Western governments being involved in, particularly Operation Gladio, which was a stay-behind army in Italy and throughout Europe, run by NATO. And in fact, we now know, it is public knowledge, that from 1960 through to 1980, the Italian Secret Service were actually setting bombs, blowing up bombs. This is the state Secret Service to blame on the communists, so that, i.e., the communism wouldn't spread through Western Europe. And this is now in the public domain. And actually, members of the Italian Secret Service and intelligence have come out and admitted that they were involved in those types of operations.
Now, hang on, John, because did this not then... This was recorded said by you, but then didn't appear in the final programme. What about other comments that were made by other contributors, maybe by the people who were on the road trip, you and your young people who were taking the trip, and also by maybe some experts who were part of the programme?
Well, the interesting things that I found about the experts that we met is none of them had actually heard of Operation Gladio. I think we met one terrorism expert, Crispin Black, who had heard of Gladio, and I put it to him, was it potentially possible that the British government would be involved in something like this? And he said there is potential for it, but he didn't think that there was, and he did know about Gladio. All these other terrorism experts that we met, Tony, had never heard of Gladio, and that we were speaking to psychologists and lawyers and people that were involved in the 7-7 trial. And my thinking is that you need to have historical context whenever you research any issue, and if there is prudence or there is form that the government have been involved in this before, potentially like we may have seen with the real IRA being initially set up by MI5, MI6. The things that the other contributors said, which was quite interesting, is we had a Muslim girl on there. Her point of view was that she just didn't think that Muslims were evil people, and that, you know, obviously I'm generalising, but she didn't think that these four men fitted the characteristics of suicide bombers. And we had another gentleman who was actually a UFOologist, and I didn't think that really he would bring any credibility to the side of seeking for truth. And we had another girl who was a model stroke tarot card reader, and I mean, she didn't really know whether she was coming or going. I had done a lot of research into this subject before I went in there, so I knew the facts, whereas these guys were pretty just were being told what they wanted to hear, in other words.
Okay, John, what was your feeling when you, as a participant in this programme, the BBC programme, the 7-7 Conspiracy Road Trip, when you actually sat and watched it going out last week?
Well, obviously it's very surreal watching yourself on the television. I would have said that I'd prefer to have lost some weight and looked a bit better shape, but I was absolutely angered and just a bit bemused why they cut me out of it. They pretty much start the programme with me and try and put me across as an extreme individual because I think that these false flag attacks are to continue the wars in the Middle East. Is this government's justification to continue the wars in the Middle East? And they pretty much, and the presenter says, well, I think that's nonsense from the first moment of the programme, so it's totally biased. But I did see that there was that was likely to happen. Obviously, it is the BBC, and they have to support the British Empire. I got very, very angry when, obviously, the bit about the public and independent inquiry getting cut out from all of those different people.
It sounds pretty systematic. Well, I'll tell you what, John Scobie, I think what we'll do is we'll see how you get on with your complaint to the BBC and maybe have you on again once we get some results from that, because it does sound to me that Renegade Productions have rather taken the mickey by taking you off on a bit of a almost like a sort of wild goose chase there. Anyway, right, thanks very much for joining us, John, we'll stay in touch.
Cheers.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now I'm joined by Steve Satan from Rail Future. Steve, hearing a little announcement from you this week that the Bristol City Council has managed to there's a lot of cuts going on at the moment. They've managed to find £5 million for this bus rapid transit project.
Yeah, they've agreed last week to spend, I think it's £4.5 million. It's certainly an awful lot of money on consultants and so on to keep the sort of controversial bus rapid transit project on track. Now, obviously, I'm one of many people who is opposed to this, and we were down at the council house sort of protesting on Thursday last week, despite the fact of loads of sort of, you know, quite articulate arguments being put forward. The cabinet sort of just blustered about improved transport, great improvement, blah blah blah.
But hang on a minute,
it's all nonsense, of course.
Aren't you just a bit of a Luddite? You don't want to see this.
Absolutely
new new technology to be brought into the city. The idea being that it's going to bring from several sort of spirals out from the centre. It's going to be able to bring people backwards into work and out back home every day, and maybe into do the shopping later in the day much more quickly and easily.
Well, no, that's the whole point. It won't be much more quickly and easy. But BRT2 is such an ill thought out turkey of a scheme. It's going to be an absolute waste of £50 million, and it will bring absolutely no transport benefits whatsoever.
Now,
it's a joke.
Okay, you're saying £50 million for the whole project, but what are we getting for this £5 million that the council have now agreed?
Well, it's ongoing consultancy, design, planning, compulsory purchase, blah 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 blah. You know.
So this is enabling money to make sure that in the future we're not actually going to get anything in terms of transport for this £5 million.
No, I mean, you could argue that if this was a good idea, then it's part of the cost of it, and it's sound money. But there's two major things, major sort of spanners in the works that may crop up in the future, and for that reason we and many others are saying, whoa, hold on, we shouldn't spend this money just yet. And the two spanners in the works are the mayoral contest. A new mayor may come in and scrap it, as some have pledged to do. And quite wisely, those who have pledged to scrap BRT2 will get my vote. And secondly, the Transport and Works Act. There was a public inquiry a few months back. Now, that's not going to report for a few months yet. And that could report that actually it's a very bad idea and it shouldn't go ahead. And in either of those cases, this £5 million will have been spent and utterly wasted. So it makes a lot of sense to just say, whoa, hold on a sec, as indeed some councillors have done. Now, this week, Jeff Gollop and who's the other senior Tory, I can't remember, in the city council, and also Charlotte Leslie are saying that it should have been stopped, and actually they've called in the decision. They've taken steps to sort of say, "Whoa, you know, this was a very bad decision, and it needs further scrutiny."
But it's all very well criticising what they're doing, Tim Kent and his team, mm-hmm. the Lib Dem, and the transport people. But what would you do with the $5 million and the $50 million if you had a say in this decision? Because we clearly have a diabolical transport problem in
this
city.
Absolutely.
I mean, I was chatting to some first group first bus drivers the other day who were saying that a lot of the first bus drivers were poached for the Olympics, went up to London and haven't come back.
Right,
so
okay.
What's happening is in the morning rush hour, you know, sometimes up to two buses in a schedule are just simply not arriving because first don't have the bus drivers.
Well, there are plenty of things which are non-controversial, which are widely supported. You know, BRT2 has an awful lot of opposition from loads and loads of different transport groups. But the most obvious glaring one that is just gagging to be sorted out is Portishead. You know, it would cost a fraction of the cost of BRT2. It would solve congestion on the A road, the name of which I can't remember, that comes into town. You know, it takes more than an hour to commute, and you could take the train in 19 minutes, 17 minutes, I think, actually. And it's such a no-brainer.
It is a no-brainer, isn't it? Because there's been a massive development in Portishead. Mm. Lots and lots of these luxury flats have been built.
Absolutely.
There's loads of people living in there who'd love to be able to get in and out of Bristol easily.
Yeah, and it's said that it's certainly one of the largest towns that isn't sort of fed by a railway. And there's improvements on the Severn Beach Line we could there's a new Bristol Metro which everyone sort of supports. There's stations that could be reopened, notably Salford, and so
the
on
new
so
Bristol
on.
Metro, tell us a little bit about that. Where would that go from to?
Well, it's a massive step change in improving local rail services. We have the Severn Beach Line and we have one or two other suburban services, but there's huge potential for growth, notably the Henbury Loop, which is, I don't know, a sort of circular route that is currently used for freight, which goes sort of northwest Bristol. Put a new station in at Filton, and you know, you will have a massively improved passenger service, regular hourly services rather than the whatever they are, 40 minutes or regular half hour services rather than 40 minutes, and so on and so on. It's just a package of local rail improvement measures, but the key point is everyone supports it, everyone realises it's a good idea. So why aren't we doing the non-controversial things that everyone supports rather than doing the barking mad controversial things which will waste £50 million, which loads of people oppose? It's insane. Well, I can tell you why if you want.
Go on then,
Well, okay, how much time you got? It goes back to both this government and the previous government saying that they're being horrified by the cost of rail generally, so they want to support cheaper alternative. And someone says, well, we can put a guided bus in, that'll be cheaper to run because that doesn't need a subsidy. So they offer loads of money to bribe people to put in guided buses. And there was the very controversial one in Cambridge, which was three times over budget and ended up being much more expensive than the railway. So they offer these local authorities money, grants for guided buses, and tempted by this carrot of money for public transport, someone in Bristol City Council says, oh, where can we squeeze a guided bus? I know, we'll stick one down the harbour side, regardless of whether it actually makes any sense in transport terms, regardless of whether it would actually improve the service on the existing buses. They bulldozer it through, and you know, they're tempted by this carrot of money and not by whether it actually makes any sense in transport terms.
Okay, what's your view at Rail Future about what's been going on with the West Coast Main Line franchise? Because we've been talking about that earlier on today, hearing that there was one of the non-executive directors of First Group involved in an inappropriate way in some of the advice that was given. There are two inquiries now apparently going into that dreadful decision which was overturned last week, and those inquiries are also being questioned. People saying, well, the people that are conducting them are actually involved in the process, and this is not going to be a proper inquiry, it's going to be a cover-up.
That may be the case. I mean, there's no doubt that this is a monstrous fiasco that is going to end up costing the taxpayer. Some civil servants got it wrong, and some people have said for some time, look, there's a huge mistake in the way you assess these. What's going on here is that the Treasury wants to get rid of the risk, basically, the risk of future passenger numbers falling or future inflation growing or anything like that. So they try and dump that on the private sector by inviting them to sort of bid as high a bid as possible. But of course, you know, if you're a private sector company and you want to hedge against risk, you're going to quote a very, very high price for that, aren't you?
Okay. Martin, you were talking about subsidy in the first hour of rails. Yep. What did you say, that there's a difference now between the amount of taxpayers' money which goes to subsidise the railways and what it was before privatisation.
Yeah, I mean, there's basically the amount of subsidy going to the railways is about three times, 300%, what it was under nationalisation. Now, this seems a bit odd to me. If you've got something that's not making money, and of course it's not the commuter stuff makes money, it's the network and keeping the network going that costs money. And of course, most other countries recognise that you can't actually make money on rail. You subsidise it in order to make your economy run more efficiently. And you basically recognise that you're going to lose money on it, but that's why they're in the public sector, because it can't be run at a profit.
Well, it's also,
but we've got this fantasy that we can run it at a profit at the same time as we subsidise it three times more than
well,
we used to illustrate, when it was in the public sector.
To illustrate this point, we've had news today that May Gurney admitted that it's losing money in the Bristol City Council's waste contract and has issued a profit warning. So they could be going under, I mean, in which case our bins won't be being collected.
Well, exactly. The same thing happened with Southern Cross with this big...
The care homes,
care homes. I mean, you don't want basic infrastructure to go bust on you, do you?
Okay.
So therefore it should be properly
The final
properly
sentence
funded.
To you, Steve.
Scrap BRT2 now.
Okay.
It's a turkey.
Thanks very much. Well, time to sign off. But that's just the start of your Friday night talk radio extravaganza, because coming up next, the third or fourth in the new all-live typical topical Afro-tropical show. Next week, we've invited all the main mayor candidates to answer questions about housing for a two-hour special. My name's Tony Gosling, and if you want to find us on the internet, you'll find us at thisweek.org.uk, and see you next week.
From the Sky News Centre.